Chapter 27. A theistical sect which has been the cause of so much scandal among the German principalities. In the course of his investigations, he became aware that the order had secretly established a lodge in Pianura, and hastening hither from Rome to advise your highness of the fact, as discovered in the so-called Count Heiligenstern, one of the most notorious apostles of the order. He turned to the priest. Signor Abate, he said, you confirm these facts? The Abate de Crucis quietly advanced. He was a slight pale man of about 30, with a thoughtful and indulgent cast of countenance. In every particular, said he, bowing profoundly to the Duke, and speaking in a low voice of singular sweetness. It has been my duty to track this man's career from its ignoble beginning to its infamous culmination, and I have been able to place in the hands of the Holy Office the most complete proofs of his guilt. The so-called Count Heiligenstern is the son of a tailor in a small village of Pomerania. After passing through various vicissitudes with which I need not trouble your highness, he obtained the confidence of the notorious Dr. Weishaupt, the founder of the German Order of the Illuminati, and together this precious couple have indefatigably propagated their obscene and blasphemous doctrines. That they preach atheism and tyrannicide I need not tell your highness, but it is less generally known that they have made these infamous doctrines the cloak of private vices from which even paganism would have recoiled. The man now before me, among other open offenses against society, is known to have seduced a young girl of noble family in Ratisbon, and to have murdered her child. His own wife and children he long since abandoned and disowned, and the youth yonder, whom he describes as a Georgian slave rescued from the Grand Signior's galleys, is in fact the wife of a Greek juggler of Ravenna, and has forsaken her husband to live in criminal intercourse with an atheist and assassin. This indictment, pronounced with an absence of emotion which made each word cut the air like the separate stroke of a lash, was followed by a prolonged silence. Then one of the Duchess's ladies cried out suddenly, and burst into tears. This was the signal for a general outbreak. The room was filled with a confusion of voices, and among the groups surging about Imoto noticed a number of the Duke's spurii making their way quietly through the crowd. The notary of the Holy Office advanced toward Heiligenstern, who had placed himself against the wall, with one arm flung about his trembling acolyte. The Duchess, her boy still clasped against her, remained proudly seated. But her eyes met Odo's in a glance of terrified entreaty, and at the same instant he felt a clutch on his sleeve, and heard Cantapresto's whisper. Cavalier, a boat waits at the landing below the Tanner's Lane. The shortest way to it is through the gardens, and your excellency will find the gate beyond the Chinese pavilion unlocked. He had vanished before Odo could look round. The latter still wavered, but as he did, so he caught Tresker's face through the crowd. The minister's eye was fixed on him, and the discovery was enough to make him plunge through the narrow wake left by Cantapresto's retreat. Odo made his way unhindered to the anteroom, which was also thronged, ecclesiastics, servants and even beggars from the courtyard jostling each other in their struggle to see what was going forward. The confusion favored his escape, and a moment later he was hastening down the tapestry gallery and through the vacant corridors of the palace. He was familiar with half a dozen shortcuts across this network of passages, but in his bewilderment he pressed on down the great stairs and across the echoing guard room that opened on the terrace. A drowsy sentinel challenged him, and on Odo's explaining that he sought to leave, and not to enter, the palace, replied that he had his highness's orders to let no one out that night. For a moment Odo was at a loss, then he remembered his passport. It seemed to him an interminable time before the sentinel had scrutinized it by the light of a guttering candle, and to his surprise he found himself in a cold sweat of fear. The rattle of the storm simulated footsteps at his heels, and he felt the blind rage of a man within shot of invisible foes. The passport restored, he plunged out into the night. It was pitch black in the gardens, and the rain drove down with the guttural rush of a midsummer storm. So fierce was its fall that it seemed to suck up the earth in its black eddies, and he felt himself swept along over a heaving, hissing surface, with wet boughs lashing out at him as he fled. From one terrace to another he dropped to lower depths of buffeting, dripping darkness, till he found his hand on the gate latch, and swung to the black lane below the wall. Thence on a run he wound to the tanner's quarter by the river, a district commonly as foul-tongued as it was ill-favored, but tonight clean purged of both evils by the vehement sweep of the storm. Here he groped his way among slippery places, and past huddled-out buildings to the piles of the wharf. The rain was now subdued to a noiseless vertical descent, through which he could hear the tap of the river against the piles. Scarce knowing what he fled, or whither he was flying, he let himself down the steps, and found the flat of a boat's bottom underfoot. A boatman, distinguishable only as a black bulk in the stern, steadied his descent with outstretched hand. Then the bow swung round, and after a laboring stroke or two they caught the current, and were swept down through the rushing darkness. Book 3. The Choice. The vision touched him on the lips and said, "Hereafter thou shalt eat me in thy bread, drink me in all thy kisses, feel my hand steal twixt thy palm and joys, and see me stand watchful at every crossing of the ways, the insatiate lover of thy nights and days." 3.1. It was at Naples, some 2 years later, that the circumstances of his flight were recalled to Odo Valseca by the sound of a voice which at once mysteriously connected itself with the incidents of that wild night. He was seated with a party of gentlemen in the saloon of Sir William Hamilton's famous villa of Posilippo, where they were sipping the ambassador's iced sherbet and examining certain engraved gems and burial urns recently taken from the excavations. The scene was such as always appealed to Odo's fancy. The spacious room, luxuriously fitted with carpets and curtains in the English style, and opening on the prospect of classical beauty and antique renown, in his hands the rarest specimens of that buried art which, like some belated golden harvest, was now everywhere thrusting itself through the Neapolitan soil, and about him men of taste and understanding, discussing the historic or mythological meaning of the objects before them, and quoting Homer or Horace in corroboration of their guesses. Several visitors had joined the party since Odo's entrance, and it was from a group of these later arrivals that the voice had reached him. He looked round, and saw a man of refined and scholarly appearance, dressed en ab, as was the general habit in Rome and Naples, and holding in one hand the celebrated blue vase cut in cameo which Sir William had recently purchased from the Barberini family. "These reliefs," the stranger was saying, "whether cut in the substance itself, or afterward affixed to the glass, certainly belong to the Grecian period of cameo work, and recall by the purity of their design the finest carvings of Dioscorides." His beautifully modulated Italian was tinged by a slight foreign accent, which seemed to connect him still more definitely with the episode his voice recalled. Odo turned to a gentleman at his side, and asked the speaker's name. "That," was the reply, "is the Abate de Crucis, a scholar and cognizant, as you perceive, and at present attached to the household of the papal nuncio." Instantly Odo beheld the tumultuous scene in the Duke's apartments, and heard the indictment of Heiligenstern falling in tranquil accents from the very lips which were now, in the same tone, discussing the date of a Greek cameo vase. Even in that moment of disorder he had been struck by the voice and aspect of the agent of the Holy Office, and by a singular distinction that seemed to set the man himself above the coil of passions in which his action was involved. To Odo's spontaneous, yet reflective temper there was something peculiarly impressive in the kind of detachment which implies, not obtuseness or indifference, but a higher sensitiveness disciplined by choice. Now he felt a renewed pang of regret that such qualities should be found in the service of the opposition, but the feeling was not incompatible with a wish to be more nearly acquainted with their possessor. The 2 years elapsing since Odo's departure from Pianura had widened if they had not lifted his outlook. If he had lost something of his early enthusiasm, he had exchanged it for a larger experience of cities and men, and for the self-command born of varied intercourse. He had reached a point where he was able to survey his past dispassionately, and to disentangle the threads of the intrigue in which he had so nearly lost his footing. The actual circumstances of his escape were still wrapped in mystery. He could only conjecture that the Duchess, foreseeing the course events would take, had planned with Cantapresto to save him in spite of himself. His nocturnal flight down the river had carried him to Ponte di Po, the point where the Piana flows into the Po, the latter river forming for a few miles the southern frontier of the duchy. Here his passport had taken him safely past the customs officer, and following the indications of the boatman, he had found, outside the miserable village clustered about the customs, a traveling chaise which brought him before the next nightfall to Monte Loro. Of the real danger from which this timely retreat had removed him, Gamba's subsequent letters had brought ample proof. It was indeed mainly against himself that both parties, perhaps jointly, had directed their attack, designing to take him in the toils ostensibly prepared for the Illuminati. His evasion known, the Holy Office had contented itself with imprisoning a legenstern in one of the papal fortresses near the Adriatic, while his mistress, though bred in the Greek confession, was confined in a convent of the Sepult Vive, and his Oriental servant sent to the Duke's galleys. As to those suspected of affiliations with the forbidden sect, fines and penances were imposed on a few of the least conspicuous, while the chief offenders, either from motives of policy or thanks to their superior adroitness, were suffered to escape without a reprimand. After this, Gamba's letters reported, the duchy had lapsed into its former state of quiescence. Prince Ferrand had been seriously ailing since the night of the electrical treatment, but the Pope having sent his private physician to Pianura, the boy had rallied under the latter's care. The Duke, as was natural, had suffered an acute relapse of piety, spending his time in expiatory pilgrimages to the various votive churches of the duchy, and declining to transact any public business till he should have compiled with his own hand a calendar of the lives of the saints, with the initial letters painted in miniature, which he designed to present to His Holiness at Easter. Meanwhile Odo, at Monte Loro, found himself in surroundings so different from those he had left, that it seemed incredible they should exist in the same world. The Duke of Monte Loro was that rare survival of a stronger age, a cynic. In a period of sentimental optimism, of fervid enthusiasms and tearful philanthropy, he represented the pleasure-loving prince of the Renaissance, crushing his people with taxes, but dazzling them with festivities, infuriating them by his disregard of the public welfare, but fascinating them by his good looks, his tolerance of old abuses, his ridicule of the monks, and by the careless libertinage which had founded the fortunes of more than one middle-class husband and father, for the Duke always paid well for what he appropriated. He had grown old in his pleasant sins, and these, as such raiment will, had grown old and dingy with him. But if no longer splendid, he was still splendor-loving, and drew to his court the most brilliant adventurers of Italy. Spite of his preference for such company, he had a nobler side, the ruins of a fine but uncultivated intelligence, and a taste for all that was young, generous and high in looks and courage. He was at once drawn to Odo, who instinctively addressed himself to these qualities, and whose conversation and manners threw into relief the vulgarity of the old Duke's cronies. The latter was the shrewd enough to enjoy the contrast at the expense of his sycophant's vanity, and the Cavalier Valsecca was for a while the reigning favorite. It would have been hard to say whether his patron was most tickled by his zeal for economic reforms, or by his faith in the perfectibility of man. Both these articles of Odo's creed drew tears of enjoyment from the old Duke's puffy eyes, and he was never tired of declaring that only his hatred for his nephew of Pianura induced him to accord his protection to so dangerous an enemy of society. Odo at first fancied that it was in response to a mere whim of the Duke's that he had been dispatched to Monte Loro, but he soon perceived that the invitation had been inspired by Maria Clementina's wish. Some 3 months after Odo's arrival, Cantapresto suddenly appeared with a packet of letters from the Duchess. Among them her Highness had included a few lines to Odo, whom she briefly adjured not to return to Pianura, but to comply in all things with her uncle's desires. Soon after this the old Duke sent for Odo, and asked him how his present mode of life agreed with his tastes. Odo, who had learned that frankness was the surest way to the Duke's favor, replied that, while nothing could be more agreeable than the circumstances of his sojourn at Monte Loro, he must own to a wish to travel when the occasion offered. "Why, this is as I fancied," replied the Duke, who held in his hand an open letter on which Odo recognized Maria Clementina's seal. "We have always," he continued, "spoken plainly with each other, and I will not conceal from you that it is for your best interests that you should remain away from Pianura for the present. The Duke, as you doubtless divine, is anxious for your return, and Her Highness, for that very reason, is urgent that you should prolong your absence. It is notorious that the Duke soon wearies of those about him, and that your best chance of regaining his favor is to keep out of his reach, and let your enemies hang themselves in the noose they have prepared for you. For my part, I am always glad to do an ill turn to that sniveling friar, my nephew, and the more so when I can seriously oblige a friend. And, as you have perhaps guessed, the Duke dares not ask for your return, while I show a fancy for your company. But this," added he with an ironical twinkle, "is a tame place for a young man of your missionary temper, and I have a mind to send you on a visit to that arch-tyrant Ferdinand of Naples, in whose dominions a man may yet burn for heresy, or be drawn and quartered for poaching on a nobleman's preserves. I am advised that some rare treasures have lately been taken from the excavations there, and I should be glad if you would oblige me by acquiring a few for my gallery. I will give you letters to a cognizant of my acquaintance, who will put his experience at the disposal of your excellent taste, and the funds at your service will, I hope, enable you to outbid the English brigands who, as the Romans say, would carry off the Colosseum, if it were portable." In all this Odo discerned Maria Clementina's hand, and an instinctive resistance made him hang back upon his patron's proposal. But the only alternative was to return to Pianura, and every letter from Gamba urged on him, for the very reasons the Duke had given, the duty of keeping out of reach as the surest means of saving himself, and the cause to which he was pledged. Nothing remained but a graceful acquiescence, and early the next spring he started for Naples. His first impulse had been to send Cantapresto back to the Duchess. He knew that he owed his escape me grave difficulties to the soprano's prompt action on the night of Hale Genstern's arrest, but he was equally sure that such action might not always be as favorable to his plans. It was plain that Cantapresto was paid to spy on him, and that whenever Odo's intentions clashed with those of his would-be protectors the soprano would side with the latter. But there was something in the air of Monte Loro which dispelled such considerations, or at least, weakened the impulse to act on them. Cantapresto as usual had attracted notice at court. His glibness and versatility amused the Duke, and to Odo he was as difficult to put off as a bad habit. He had become so accomplished a servant that he seemed a sixth sense of his master's. And when the latter prepared to start on his travels, Cantapresto took his usual seat in the chaise. To a traveler of Odo's temper there could be few more agreeable journeys than the one on which he was setting out, and the Duke being in no haste to have his commission executed, his messenger had full leisure to enjoy every stage of the way. He profited by this to visit several of the small principalities north of the Apennines, before turning toward Genoa, whence he was to take ship for the south. When he left Monte Loro, the land had worn the bleached face of February, and it was amazing to his northern bred eyes to find himself, on the sea coast, in the full exuberance of summer. Seated by this halcyon shore, Genoa, in its carved and frescoed splendor, just then celebrating with the customary gorgeous ritual the accession of a new doge, seemed to Odo. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.